This is a Triple J podcast.
Hello, welcome back to another episode of Science with Dr. Carl, where this week we learnt the term shampoo, and it's not what you think. We also found out why we need oxygen and how sharks heat their food. I'm Lucy Smith. To kick us off, I've got a question from Breakfast, Bryce and Conchetta. They were having a debate about whether we need to clean between our toes. The jury's out. Half the audience reckon you absolutely need to. You get in there with an exfoliator. The other half reckon just showering does the job. We put it to Dr. Carl. Should we be worried about the bacteria between our toes?
Bacteria and yeast. And if you've managed to survive for many years without washing between your toes and have never had any problems such as infections or really stinky feet, then there's no real grounds for changing what you do. But you might change your shoe wear, might wear shoes that are more trapping of moisture, might move to a more humid environment, in which case you should. The general thing is, of course, you have to wash your feet and you should use a Miles soap and then scrub it in between and then let them dry properly and all that sort of stuff. I actually ran into this myself as maybe at the age of 8 in the Little Flower Primary School when I was a kid, and I was having trouble with the school shoes, which were sort of these hard, unyielding blocks of leather, and I managed to convince my parents to let me wear socks and sandals. Oh my God, I had found heaven. On one hand, I had the protection of the shoes, but I also had no sweat and my feet were breathing, but I managed to get a huge amount of social opprobrium and jeering, which still happens whenever I wear socks and sandals, so I've given up.
What? People didn't like the fashion choice of the socks and sandals.
They still don't.
Okay, damn.
Funny that. I don't know what to do. Yeah. I think Bryce and Conchetta are too cool to wear socks with sandals.
Maybe I don't think they are.
Really?
I don't think they are. I think they could wear. They could rock a sock and a sandal.
Well, I remember when I was fabulously poor as a drug-crazed hippie, my clothes were torn, and now people pay money to have that happen.
Yeah.
So, you know,
jeans.
And with regard to wraparound sunglasses, I hang on to the same set all the time because I had some advice from Fred Hollows way back to wear wraparound sunglasses because it stops the yellow patches developing on your eyes because it stops the ultraviolet from coming into the side.
On the side.
You've got to do is be strong.
Yep.
So what happens is they'll say, hey, you look really cool. And 5 years later they'll say, oh, man, that's so uncool. And then 5 years after that, you're cool again. So all you've got to be is strong, and every 10 years they come back into cycle,
yep.
Into fashion.
Wraparound sunnies have never gone out of fashion.
Except every 5 years. Right.
Except
now they're
every
in
five
probably.
Years. Yeah,
okay. But then the toes, look, I mean, do you do your toes?
No.
No.
Maybe every so often when I go and get a pedicure or something like that.
Yeah.
Or when I notice that the skin is kind of maybe hanging off.
Okay.
And I'll go in there and I'll give it an exfoliate. But
right.
Apart from that, no. We have a question here to kick us off from Madeline in Sydney. Dr. Madeline, what do you want to know?
Hi, guys. My question is, when I open my great uncle's tool kit, it's really old and I guess the tools are a little bit rusted. I get this really painful sensation in my gums, like I can smell the iron and it's like something's targeting my gums right under particularly my bottom teeth. And I was wondering what it was.
I don't know. Of itself, rust is not going to cause those reactions, but the rust, which is porous and non-adherent, that rust may have been invaded by an iron-loving fungus, which is floating in the air in the toolbox, and that is the thing that's setting you off. But firstly, I don't know if there is a bacterial or fungal invasion, and secondly, even if there was, why would it set off on you're saying the gums on your lower jaw?
Yeah, like the whole experience makes me feel quite nauseous, so I rarely open the toolkit. But yeah, particularly my gums. And like, I'm iron deficient, so I wondered if that was part of it, but I don't know.
Oh, my God.
I hate opening this toolkit.
This sounds like something for the case history page of the New England Journal of Medicine, where you get all sorts of world experts who come together to discuss it and come up with an answer. I'm not that person, so I think I failed you. You can clean the tools by putting them either in molasses for 24 hours and taking them out, or vinegar, or even go through and get the spinning wire brush and get rid of all the rust. The thing about tools is that they last forever if you take care of them, and then you could have that feeling of being close to your relative and thinking, I'm keeping these tools for my kids or nieces or nephews for the next generation.
But what is happening in the body when you get a funny feeling in your nerves and something does get on your nerves? So for Madeline, it's a smell. When I hear scraping
metal on concrete. I feel like I can feel it in my body.
Okay,
What's happening there?
With the hearing the sounding thing, it is claimed, the current claim, which has been around for a while, is that that screeching noise is similar to the alarm signal of the primates who live in the trees of Africa. And so we left the trees about 2 million years ago, but it's still buried there somewhere deep in our DNA. So when you hear that screeching noise, it gets triggered. The smell thing, all I'm thinking of is that it has to have molecules of something, which can be the parasites, the yeast, the bacteria, and the iron going up into her nose and landing. But why it would set off the reaction in the gums, and particularly the lower gums, that's got me interested. I don't know. Maybe we need a dentist.
Thanks, Madeline.
Thank you, Dr. Madeline. Thank you for starting us with some good I don't knows, which can lead to Nobel Prizes for somebody further down the line.
We've got Luke in Brizzy. Dr. Luke, you saw something on Reddit the other day. What was it?
Yeah, I saw a photo and a guy who posted it said he hasn't bent his finger for 10 years and the bend lines on the inside of the hand had disappeared. Just wondering if that could actually happen. And then if you changed your facial movement, could wrinkles and other marks disappear from your skin as well?
That's the basis of the Botox. So the Botox is a temporary neurotoxin, which if given specifically in very low doses, specifically to specific areas, can paralyze the muscles and then the wrinkle lines go away. But the how do you make sure you don't bend your finger for 10 years? You can do it in the daytime with a splint, but you might just want to bend it subconsciously during the daytime. What happens at night? Dubious about the claim you haven't bent it for 10 years, so it might be talking about Photoshop here, but certainly it works on the forehead. But there's a feedback reaction where if you're a person who has paralyzed your forehead so you don't have any wrinkles, there's a feedback loop where you find it harder to interact empathetically with people who talk to you by their face and their nose and their eyes and their wrinkling of the eyebrows and the wrinkling of the forehead. There's a break somewhere in that feedback loop, so you become, by paralyzing yourself, less empathetic. So I'm kind of doubtful. How would you go about making sure you don't bend your finger for 10 years?
I know, how could you do that?
I mean, tied to a paddle pop stick for 10 years.
Yeah, I think he had an injury or something and he couldn't bend it.
Okay.
I thought it was just a personal challenge.
Think or you're sure? Because I'm a bit vague here.
I don't know. That's what he said because of an injury, but...
Oh, okay. So he claimed that there was an injury that kept the finger straight for 10 years. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, assume we can trust it, sure. It fits in with the whole Botox thing of the forehead. So the wrinkles go away.
So you're simply, because you're not moving it, it's not getting that range of motion.
That continual bending, and then that's a chance for fat to sort of infiltrate through. So if you think about babies, you can do this indirect experiment if you've got a brand new baby. Get your thumb and forefinger and shove one on the outside of the baby's cheek and one on the inside, and you'll feel this fat pad. And that's there to stop their cheeks from collapsing. It's maybe like a centimetre and a half thick, and it's to stop their cheeks from collapsing when they're sucking milk. And they lose that later. So there's a possibility that this person, whose finger has apparently been frozen in that position for 10 years, has grown fat, that fat has infiltrated into the place where the groove normally happens. And why it doesn't happen all the time? Because you're always bending it and pushing it back.
Wow.
I don't know. Drawing a long bow here.
Yeah, that could be an interesting thing. Luke,
wow,
thanks.
Thank you, Luke, for starting us on that pathway. You rock, Luke.
We are counting down the hottest 100 this Saturday, Jan 27, 12 p.m. Australian Eastern Daylight Time is when it kicks off. Find out what that means for your time zone via the Triple J website. Erin in Brizzy, you have a hottest 100 related question. What have you got for us? This is a bit of a curly one.
Yeah, I was just wondering if it's statistically possible to figure out the likelihood of someone's top 10 votes matching the top 10 in the countdown, because only a certain amount of songs are eligible and we have so much data from previous years. And has this ever happened before?
Okay, so how many songs are eligible for the top 100? It's at least 100, right? But would it be like 500 or 1,000 or 150? How many songs are eligible?
I don't know.
Okay, let's assume it's 200.
Think of every song that's been released in 2023.
Okay, so
let's say it's 500.
Okay, let's go 500. So imagine you've got 10 slots that you want to fill. Your chances of picking the same as the final selection are You got 500 choices for the first slot. You've used up one of them, so you only got 499 for the second slot, and then 498. And when you multiply those together, that's a really big number. So you go 500 by 499 and all the way down to 490. That's 5 by 10 squared. So 10 squared by 10 is 10 to the 20. Oh, my God. And 5 to the 10, that's 5 squared, 125. By to the fifth power, that's 10 to the 10. That's 10 to the 30. Well, 10 to the 30 is a very big number. The number of atoms in the universe is only 10 to the 80.
Oh.
So you're heading up for a large number of atoms. Oh, 10 to the 20. That's roughly the number of grains of sand on all the beaches on Earth, and roughly the number of stars in the and planets in the observable universe. So your chances are very small, but not impossible.
Someone's saying, Dr. Carl, you're not factoring in the influence of popularity. You've done those figures on people choosing songs randomly. And someone else, the maths is assuming selection is random, which it isn't. People pick the more popular songs, which is how they get into the top 10. Impossible to calculate accurately.
That's true, unless you can know what everybody is thinking, which you do by having a poll. So you are 100% correct.
Which is why we do the damn thing.
Which is why you do the damn thing, yeah.
We've got Elin in Melbourne here. Now, Elin, we've got to have a poo question every week, and you are taking it out. What have you chosen?
Right, so I never thought I'd be the person doing the poo question, but I have to know. So every time I have champagne, or like a decent quantity of champagne, I call them shampoos. I get like these fizzy smelling poos, and I've tried Googling it. There's nothing. I've tried talking to people. They just look at me like I'm crazy. But yeah, for some reason, every time I have loads of shampoo, champagne, it's I get like these fizzy smelling poos.
Dr. Carl, what is this phenomena?
Okay, so can I ask you a question? Does it happen when you have lots of sparkling water?
Ooh.
No. So the only other time, because I've done tests and I've done a few little research, it's sparkling cider, sparkling apple cider, will be the only other one where I'll slightly get the same smell.
And is that the same whether it's alcoholic or non-alcoholic cider?
Oh, I've never tried non-alcoholic sparkling cider.
Right. Hang on. That's a nice thing to have on your epitaph. She never drank non-alcoholic sparkling cider. Okay, right. So have you actually looked at the feces floating in the water to see if they're floating or sinking or if they've got a different surface?
Always. It always floats. It's a very soft one. And it's always kind of the same colour of like a light brownish.
So is there any difference in the appearance or the sound or the appearance when you've had the champagne or not?
Yeah, so it's kind of always a lighter colour, and it's normally like a bigger poo than my usual.
Okay, firstly, it could be just something as simple as the alcohol is causing the transit time of the food going through your belly to change. So the way they work out the transit time is they give you these little tiny coloured plastic cubey things and they shove them in one end, you eat them, and then they see how long it takes to come through. And the transit time, depending on your fibre intake, high fibre, people in Southern Africa, 50 grams a day, transit time about 1 day. European diet, 10 grams of fibre a day, transit time, not 24 hours, maybe 36, 48, 3 days,
so
4 days.
So it's always the morning. So it's always 12 hours.
Okay, so that's good. Fast transit time. I'm thinking that it's something to do with the microbiome. Now, just to interest you, if you go onto the Guardian website, they've got a podcast that I was listening to just this morning, and it's all about the bacteria that live in your gut and how they're even more varied than we thought. I thought that there were, say, 500 different types of bacteria living in your gut. Sure. And how many? But there's also yeast in there, and in one quarter of the people on Earth there's also worms and parasites. But then in addition to the 500 different types of bacteria, we've found different species of viruses, not 500, 150,000. And it turns out that the gut bacteria are like a machine that has to be fed, and it gives different results on what you give it. Think about an internal combustion engine. You feed it high octane petrol, low octane petrol, you get different results. And so what they're saying is that what your microbiome is what you get from your mother, and that depends on her health. If she has bad, not bad, if she has a particular set of microbiome in the birth canal, that can set you up for life to a bad start and it'll never change. Mm. By the way, a little detour here. Immediately after my son was born, I did a really stupid thing, but I'm still proud of it. I got every single visitor to shove their little finger in his mouth with the fingernail down and the soft part up, and he was thinking that it was a nipple, and he sucked like crazy, and he's really healthy. Okay, so I was trying to give him the most diverse microbiome. In retrospect, I think, what was I thinking? Not a lot. Don't do this experiment at home. So, and then it changes a lot around 3 to 5 years, and it's kind of settled. So listen to this podcast on The Guardian. It's the latest podcast about the microbiome. So I'm thinking what's happening with you is that either the alcohol is doing something to the transit time, or it's doing some other chemical reaction, or it's temporarily changing the microbiome. Like in Southern Africa, inflammatory bowel disease, unknown. Just, it doesn't exist. Mm. Rest of Western society, all over the place. So there are changes that we can do once we know more about it. And I'm guessing, totally guessing, that you're doing changes to it, but that's based entirely upon my having listened to a Guardian podcast 3 hours ago.
Mm. Yeah, the only thing I could think of was maybe because the bubbles in champagne are smaller than most other fizzy or carbonated drinks or however they make it sparkly. So I'm wondering if that was the reason. It's just like a different time of bubbles and... Yeah.
Part of me was saying yes and no. Look, number one, I agree with you, but another part of me being brutally logical says, no, the carbon dioxide doesn't exist as bubbles, but, oh, you're right. It turns out that the pressure inside a bubble is inversely proportional to the radius, so the smaller it is, the higher the pressure. So, but that would mean it might not survive. Look, what we need, and this sounds disgusting, is somebody to actually examine your feces in a proper sort of gas-controlled environment to see if they do have bubbles of carbon dioxide. And I think we could radioactively label the carbon, but that would mean we'd have to do it now, then wait for the champagne to mature, which is about a couple of years. It's a long-term experiment, but it's worthwhile doing. But you could be right. Look, you
might
have suggested
the answer. That's right, you provide the champagne, I'll provide the poo.
Shampoo is where we are headed. Aileen, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks.
I love that we got a new name for it, shampoo as well. I was used to the AGB.
What's
you heard
that?
Content warning, after grog bog.
After grog bog, it rhymes.
Yeah, exactly. That's how you remember it.
Oh, I completely forgot the whole concept of the after grog bog because I don't have that. Oh, my God. There's so much going on here.
Matt from Wongaratta.
Matt,
let's
come on down, Dr.
change
Matt.
The pace. What's your question?
G'day, doctors.
Dr. Matt.
Just my question is, I understand the need for food, it gives you energy and water hydrates, but why was oxygen critical to life evolving? Why couldn't we have just lived without oxygen?
We did for the first couple of billion years. So the Earth, 4.6 billion years old, we're pretty confident that life popped up around 3.8 billion years and that didn't need oxygen. And really, oxygen was not a major factor for about 1.5 billion years. So the creatures back then did not need oxygen. They didn't like oxygen. In fact, oxygen ended up killing them. Where did the oxygen come from? Well, some creatures evolved the thing called photosynthesis, where you grab sunlight and it's got energy in it, and you use that energy to power yourself. And so you take in stuff from the outside world, atoms from the outside world, and powered by the electricity that you get from sunlight, you can make your own body with various molecules. The trouble is that there's a very poisonous, very corrosive byproduct. And that was oxygen. And so if you look up Wikipedia, you'll find an article about the great oxygenation crisis that happened 2.2 billion years ago. And then, once photosynthesis was in, I mean, free energy, they couldn't resist it, so they just went for it, and it took over. And so the oxygen level started climbing up. So it was kind of an accident that there was this free source of energy, the sun, and that the biochemical pathway that was evolved in the early days threw oxygen off as a byproduct. It could have been possible to have a different pathway that wouldn't have oxygen as a byproduct, in which case we wouldn't be breathing oxygen today. So we're just the result of many little blind pathways and accidents, and we're stuck with breathing oxygen today.
That's great. Fantastic.
That's great. Thanks, Matt.
Thank you, Dr. Matt.
We've got Sam in Queenstown. We're going across the ditch. Sam, what's your question?
Kia ora, doctors.
I'm just
wondering, what's the most efficient way to use a hand dryer? Is it just to keep your hands in one spot until it sort of fully dries that air and move on, or sort of wave your hands about trying to dry it all at once? Mm.
What I try to do is get rid of surface drops and then smear them out to give them maximum surface area. Do you do that?
Yes, same thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you want to get any visible drops gone, and then you keep on exposing both sides of your hands to the air as fast as to give maximum interaction between the incoming air and the water on your hands. Everything happens through the surface. And if the water is on the surface, you want to expose as much surface area. And if that means flipping your hand over this way and that so that both sides dry, that's better. You can regard the source of air as an infinite source because it doesn't run out. So it's just up to you to provide the maximum amount of wetness to dry as fast as possible. I think that means moving it around. What do you do, Dr. Sam?
Yeah, a little bit of both, but last night I was, it's quite cold over here last night. I was thinking about it, and I thought tomorrow being Thursday, you'd be the perfect person to ask. I'll forever be waving my hands about in the bathroom.
Now there are various companies that do make the air dryers. I've spoken with them in the past, and unfortunately I found it difficult to get to the scientists.
Yesterday I was using one of the Dyson blades. You sort of put your hand in it, does both sides at once, but it sort of is focused on one area. So I didn't know whether to sort of keep it there and let that fully dry or so, but yeah, I'll move them about.
Now, Carl, we are getting some follow-up on the shampoo.
Ha!
Shampoo, look, I don't want to look, and I'm not talking about the shampoo that you use in your hair.
To volumise your hair.
Yeah, we are saying champagne poo. Do you want to first describe what the shampoo is for anyone who's just joining us?
I think it was Erin or Suzanne said when she has a lot of champagne, the poo the next day after 12 hours looks a little bit lighter in colour and appears to have a fizzy type sound associated with it.
Mm.
And then she raised the possibility, after I went down a few blind pathways, that perhaps some of the bubbles are trapped inside. And then I started thinking about the Laplace relationship where the pressure in a very small bubble is very high, which would mean that it would tend to dissipate and just vanish. And that's why a case of champagne is heavier than a case of wine. Even though they've got the same amount of liquid, inside each bottle of champagne, the pressure is 6 atmospheres, which keeps the tiny bubbles there. Over to you.
We are getting some similar hypotheses.
Lockie.
You said it's the preservatives that cause the bubbly poos. Guppy from Bundina saying, could the shampoo be from excess fruit? Champagne and cider, both made from fruits. I know the fructose in fresh fruits gives me the runs. And someone else saying, regarding the shampoo question, I'm tipping that the champagne may be a sparkling wine. I know we can be a little liberal when we get a sparkling white, we automatically call it champagne, but it may be that the apple concentrate is the reason for the softer and floatier poo. The clue came from the apple cider.
Yes, and we didn't ask, was it Erin or Suzanne, as to whether it was champagne from Champagne in France or a sparkling white wine.
A sparkling white wine.
And for those of you who have got, who want to know more about it, I would read the article by Professor Gerard Ligier-Belair in the December 1999 issue of the Scientific American, where he, an industrial chemist who works for a champagne company, solves the problem of how the bubbles can exist. He points out the physics of why they shouldn't exist and then works out that the only reason we can have bubbles is because of pollution of the entire environment by microcylinders of cellulose.
Mm.
So in other words, if we did not have paper or clothes, there'd be no such thing as champagne.
Mm.
You need those hollow cylinders of cellulose polluting the entire world for champagne to exist.
Wow.
December 1999, Professor Gerard Ligier-Belair, Scientific American.
Okay, well, we've got a lot to tap into. We've got Ben here in Adelaide. Ben, what is your question?
Morning, doctors.
Dr. Ben.
Yeah, so I'm just wondering, what colour would the sky be if the sunlight didn't interact with any gases as it entered our atmosphere?
Okay. The same colour as the sky in space or on moon? Just black.
Okay.
Just totally black. So think about, and this is a terrible thing to think about, but think about a machine gun bullet, and or just a bullet from a gun. If it goes past you and you don't hear the sound, it just doesn't interact with you in any way whatsoever. And so if the sunlight goes past our planet really close and there's no atmosphere, it's got nothing to interact with. And so you don't see the sunlight whizzing past, just like you don't see the bullet whizzing past. But if the bullet were to run into a tree, then you see the tree being damaged. Or if the sunlight runs into the molecules in our atmosphere, which are oxygen and nitrogen, it interacts with them. And then it's kind of like a staircasey thing. Imagine you've got a little tennis ball at the top of a set of stairs and you give it a little push. It goes forward, down, forward, down, forward, down, forward, down, until finally it lands at the bottom. In the same way, a photon of light, having been absorbed by oxygen or nitrogen in the atmosphere, is absorbed and then re-emitted, kind of like the ball. It's emitted at right angles. So it changes the direction of travel. So now it's aimed at your eyeball, and it's slightly more blue. And when it's done this 10,000 times, you can look at a part of the sky and say, aha, that's blue, and you're seeing a beam of sunlight that if there had been no atmosphere, you'd have no idea of that it even existed. But it's hit the atmosphere and has been diverted and ended up in your eyeball. Is that getting you part of the way to what you're asking, or have I left something out?
Yeah. No, that is exactly what I was asking. Yeah, it's perfect. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Ben. We've got Jack from Traralgon here. Jack, what's your question?
Hey, guys. How are you?
Very well. Thank you, Dr. Jack. Welcome.
Good. Just inquiring. With sharks, got a question about sharks. So I was just wondering, how do sharks sense blood in the water?
They have the molecules of the blood have to actually travel physically through the water to get to the receptors inside the body of the shark, inside the nose of the shark.
Ah, yes.
So they have, in the same way that when you walk into somebody's kitchen for dinner, you're having dinner at their place, if there's a Perspex wall in the kitchen running from the floor to the ceiling, you're not going to smell anything. Because all the molecules are trapped. They have to actually leave the food and end up in your nose. But rather what happens with the shark is that they have an extremely sensitive electrical sense. Now, you know those little 1.5-volt batteries? You know, like little tiny things, maybe the diameter of your little finger or thicker. Mate, imagine you've got one of those and you've got 2,000 kilometres of wire, okay? You go to the beach at Bondi and you join one wire to the positive and you run it down to Melbourne. And then you join another wire and then you put it up to Brisbane and the battery's on land, and then you put the two ends of the wire in the water. So the only thing that's in the water is 1.5 volts spread over a couple of thousand kilometres. A shark can sense that.
Mm.
Now, your muscles run electricity, and when you move your muscles, they give off electricity, and depending on the sort of pattern, they'll go for it. And by the way, the platypus has this sense related to a variant of the fifth cranial nerve, only in one nostril. So if there's a little yabby swimming around using its muscles, it can sense it. So it chases its food with its eyes shut, following the electrical sense. But sure, if the blood is close, they can smell that. And does it make it more crazed? No, I think it's just that there's lots of food. Let's just go to lunch, hungry.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he's hungry bugger.
Mm. Yeah. Oh, and by the way, also sharks have got a different trick where they're different from us. You and I, we heat our food and then we eat it. But the great white shark does it the other way around. It eats the food and then it heats it.
How?
We heat because what it does, it's got this massive liver. That's 20% of its body weight. And it wants to process that food and get it into the liver. And believe it or not, food is not everywhere in the ocean. And sharks just keep on looking for something nice and juicy like a seal. Humans are just not what they want. And imagine the terrible frustration if after a lot of hunting it had found a seal and then there was another one. So what it does is it redirects blood from its exercising muscles to around its stomach. And the whole gut heats up by an extra 10 degrees. That increases the speed at which it processes the food in its gut, and then it feeds it into the liver and stores it, and the liver gets bigger and bigger, and then that way the food is out of its gut and is ready to eat again sooner. So it eats its food first and then heats it up, whereas we do it the other way around.
That's so interesting. We've got Erin in Geelong here. Erin, what's your question?
Good morning, doctors.
Dr. Aaron.
Hello. I've got a question about body temperature. So I noticed that when I am extremely tired, I get really, really cold. And the other part of that question is that if there is an extreme, I don't know how to put it, an intense orgasm, that's the only thing.
Say it, Aaron. Say it with your chest.
Go on, say it.
Yeah, look, if you have a really, really steamy session and you have an intense orgasm, my body gets absolutely frozen.
Now, the first thing to realise is not just evil communistic terrorists that have sex. Regular people do it too, and that's how we get babies, right? So it's okay to have orgasms. In fact, it's much better too. So the way it's kind of a bit weird because you've got a central thermostat in a part of your brain called the hypothalamus. And if you reset that thermostat upwards, suddenly, at your normal temperature of 37 degrees in your mouth, that is too cold for you, and you will not feel comfortable until you get up to, say, 38 or 39. And you will say, when you're at 38 or 39, I'm still cold, because your hypothalamus is wrongly telling you that you're cold and that you're generating heat. But an outsider will touch your skin and say, you're hot. So you, honestly, inside yourself, you say, I'm feeling freezing. But if the outsider touches your skin, they'll say you're feeling hot. Have you done the experiment when you're really tired or having had an orgasm that you then ask a random passerby, is my skin hotter than normal?
No, I haven't.
You can buy these really neat little thermometers you chuck in your ears, and the good ones are about $89, and I bought a set of them because we've got a whole bunch of nieces and nephews and babies in the family. It's a bit much to ask. That was a really good orgasm. Excuse me, I'm just going to mention my ear temperature. But really, that's what you want to do, because if you can at the same time say, I feel really cold, but the thermometer says that my temperature is now 38. We're now showing that there is a resetting of your hypothalamus. Okay, we've got to that stage. We know that the conventional pathway of resetting of your hypothalamus is what's happening. But then there's a big question. What is there? What is there about an orgasm or feeling very tired that makes your hypothalamus get reset? The being tired one, I'm pretty sure I could find that out on Google Scholar. And with a bit of luck, with enlightenment, I might even be able to find the orgasm one on Google Scholar as well. Okay. All right. You've done it. It's homework for next week. All right. I hope you're happy. You've increased my workload, Aaron, but it's worthwhile doing. Okay, so
thanks, Dr. Carl. Thanks, Lucy.
Thanks, Aaron.
Well, see ya.
You got it.
The big O or tired. All right. Okay.
Cold after orgasm.
Cold after orgasm.
We've got Brendan in Sydney. What do you want to know?
Morning, doctors.
Dr. Brendan.
My question is about how could the wireless transmission of electricity happen? How is that possible?
Yeah, like I worried about this when I was having, I was watching a Derek Mueller Veritasium video on this, and then talking with Geraint Lewis, and he was saying that when you've got electricity travelling in a wire, delivering power, say, to an electric heater, which is a very inefficient thing, but forget that, that most of the energy travels through the air. And I said, how can that happen? Doesn't it travel through the copper? And he said, Carl, how do you think the energy gets from the sun to Earth? Does it travel through copper wires or does it travel through empty space? I said, empty space. He said, that's what happens. So there is energy in the invisible electromagnetic field. So when you've got a transformer on a street, you can see these little boxes. They're maybe a metre and a half by a metre and a half by a metre and a half, and they've got all these bits. They look metallic. They take in 11,000 volts and they turn it into 240 volts, and there's no physical contact. There are little tiny gaps of the order of maybe a few millimetres. And then when you're charging up your electric toothbrush, the electricity travels through that tiny gap. And then with some of the modern phones, they've got wireless charging. Same thing again. So the energy can travel through an electromagnetic field, through a vacuum or air. And if you're thinking that's hard, just remember, how does the energy get from the sun to us? Not on copper wires, through an electromagnetic field. The person to read up on here is Maxwell and Faraday, and Wikipedia. Is that too much homework for you, Dr. Brendan?
No, not at all. I guess from the bits of information I've seen on different feeds and stuff, I'm assuming that is it a science that can be scaled up to like replace power grids?
The power you can deliver falls off with distance. So you can send power a few millimetres or three or four. But metres, whole different ballpark.
We've got Emily and Newey. Emily, what's your question?
Hello, doctors.
Dr. Wimmy.
Dr. Carl, I was lucky enough to have a trip to Europe at the end of last year, and it got me wondering, I always feel way worse jet lag when I travel west to east, not east to west around the globe. Why is that? Am I just excited to be on my holiday on the way, or is there a science to it?
Okay, suppose you're going from Sydney to Perth. Mm-hmm. So that's travelling east to west, is it?
East to west, correct, yeah.
Now, is that, you're saying that's the
easy? That's when I feel good I feel bad going the opposite way.
Okay, so let's just stick with, you're going from the east coast of Australia to Perth, and assume it's not daylight saving time, and it's only 2 hours difference. It turns out, and I'm sorry to inform you this at this late stage in your life, Dr. Emily, but your natural body clock is not 24 hours. It's 25 hours.
Mm.
If you get a bunch of humans and stick them underground and let them find their own rhythm, it's 25 hours. So going that way, the extra hour just sort of fits in with what your body naturally wants. But coming back, you instead of having 1 hour extra in a day, you got, instead of having 2 hours extra in a day, you got 2 hours less coming from Perth over to the East Coast, and then you suddenly find yourself that you're feeling bad. Now, there's a whole thing on jet lag, and it involves melatonin and not eating and all that other sort of stuff, which we should talk about another time. But it's basically, in your case, related to the fact that your body clock is 25 hours, not 24.
Okey-doke.
And last thing, and sorry to interrupt you, but you can compensate 1 hour a day on general. I've got a jet lag cure, but we'll talk about that another time.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of Science with Dr. Carl. If you want to be a part of the Science with Dr. Carl fam, make sure you've liked, subscribed, and you can always take a scroll through the podcast feed for previous episodes. This episode was produced by Sarah Harvey and Nick Gerber. I'm Lucy Smith. We'll catch you next week. Bye.
Dave Marchese here from the Triple J Hack team. Hey, if you love Dr. Carl's podcast like I do, you might enjoy the Hack podcast as well. Each day, we bring you the news that matters to you, from the latest science on climate change to what's happening in politics and news around the world. The Hack podcast. It's your daily fix of the news you need to know. Get it wherever you're listening now.